adepts in the Stockholm underworld who paid him well for his services. That was how Red Zepi got involved. First as a favour to Armitage because his friends needed a driver for a robbery one night, and then later when they realised he was both trustworthy and not afraid to get blood on his hands, they recruited him for other, more dangerous jobs. It was good, quick money. And it wasn't far to Norway, which was where he'd met Erjan Mjerns, a man who plied him, and the others, with work. Every time they'd done a job, they went back to Sweden to lie low for a while. The reverse if they'd done a job in Sweden. Red Zepi sent part of what he earned back to his brother, who, in turn, paid for people to keep looking for his girls. And he was still waiting for an answer. Of course he knew they might possibly be buried, like so many others, in a mass grave that had not yet been discovered. But he would never give up. Every evening before he fell asleep, he thought about them, about where they were and what they were doing, how they would look when he met them again. 3/4 of an hour passed before Red Zepi heard a car pull up beside his. He went over to the kitchen window and saw a tall man get out of a car that looked like it cost a fortune. The man was wearing a suit and a dark overcoat, and he had a briefcase in his hand. The remains of the afternoon light seemed to focus on the man's shoes, making them gleam. Red Zepi went out onto the step to wait for Daddy Longlegs.
"You're late," he said.
"Apologies," Daddy Longlegs said. "It's been a rather hectic day, mainly thanks to you," he smiled. "Did anyone see you?"
"Difficult to say."
Red Zepi welcomed him in with a nod. Daddy Longlegs rubbed his hands together as he entered and looked around. He nodded to himself. Red Zepi realized from his expression that Daddy Longlegs was used to something more upmarket than pine walls and red-checked curtains. The tall man walked over to the kitchen counter, picked up a glass that was standing on a tea towel, and held it up towards the light before filling it from the tap. When he'd emptied the glass, he put it down and said,
"Gunderson, did you get anything out of him?"
Red Zepi shook his head before answering.
"But I don't think he'd managed to tell Yule anything yet. They were going to meet later on today."
Daddy Longlegs nodded slowly and put his briefcase down on the kitchen counter, opened it with 2 synchronized clicks, and handed Red Zepi some papers and a photograph. Red Zepi looked at a man with a strong jaw, muscular neck, and cropped hair. The skin on his face was flushed red. There were palm trees in the background.
"Is that the Chippy?"
Red Zepi asked. Daddy Longlegs nodded.
"The photograph is a few years old, so he may of course look a little different now."
Red Zepi mentally stored the carpenter's face and tried to imagine what he might look like now. People who went into hiding often changed their appearance. If they had short hair, they let it grow. And if they had long hair, they generally cut it short. They often dyed it as well. There was also a lot of other things you could do with your appearance. Put on weight, or the opposite. Red Zepi tried to picture all permutations, but closely the area around the eyes in particular. That seldom changed.
"Everything ready for the funeral?" Daddy Longlegs asked.
"It is."
"Good. There's a bonus waiting for you if it all goes according to plan. You need the money, don't you? It's been a while since you sent anything back to your brother."
Red Zepi looked up from the photograph and instead studied the man in front of him. It took a moment before he actually understood what Daddy Longlegs had just said.
"Yes, I know about your girls too, Reds," Daddy Longlegs said. "They're called Svetlana and Dorantina, aren't they?
Red Zeppi was initially glued to the spot, but then he threw down the papers and grabbed Daddy Longlegs by his coat and pushed him up against the kitchen cupboard.
What do you know about my family?
I know why you're doing this, Daddy Longlegs said, unperturbed. You're looking for them.
What do you know about my girls?
I know all I need to know.
Red Zeppi pushed him up even harder against the cupboard. Daddy Longlegs rolled his eyes as though he was already bored of this game.
I never do business with anyone without knowing as much as I can about them first, he said. That shouldn't surprise you.
Tell me what you know about Svetlana and Dorantina now.
Red Zeppi's voice quivered. Daddy Longlegs smacked his lips.
That's not the way it works, Reds. Could you,
He made a gesture. He wanted him to let go, but Red Zeppi pushed him further up the cupboard. Daddy Longlegs let out a theatrical sigh.
I've got some information that you might be interested in, and yes, it's about your family. But if I'm going to give you that information, you're going to give me what I need first. There's no reason why this shouldn't be win-win for both of us.
Red Zeppi gave no sign of letting go. Daddy Longlegs looked like he found the whole thing rather tedious. Suddenly, Red Zeppi let go. Daddy Longlegs' shoes rapped on the wooden floor. He puffed and straightened his coat. Then he smiled again, pointed to the papers lying on the floor, and indicated that Red Zeppi should pick them up. While he did this, Daddy Longlegs filled another glass of water and produced a pill box from the inner pocket of his coat. He took out two pills and swallowed them with water.
Angina pectoris, he said,
and removed a drop of water from his lower lip with his tongue.
I had an aunt who once thought it was called vagina pectoris.
It's true, he laughed.
But it does actually sound like a sexual disease, he finished, laughing at his own joke.
It's a lot to do, all at the same time, Red Zeppi said. There's Jewel as well.
Daddy Longlegs was done with laughing.
Yes, it is, he said, all at once serious.
But you'll manage. Keep your focus in the days ahead, Reds. Do what you have to, and then I'll tell you what I know about your girls.
Chapter 12. Even though her work was calling, Pierre Nurkleby took her time walking up to the fourth floor, past smells of food and the rubbish bags and shoes that were standing outside doors on the stairs. She thought about Henning, about the look in his eyes, increasingly distant, before he sat down on the pavement with his knees drawn up. He hadn't cared about the damp air or the wet ground. Nurkleby had used Henning's phone to call for a taxi, but when the car drove off, she wasn't sure that he'd asked the driver to go to the police headquarters as she had requested. She didn't like what she had seen in his eyes just before he left, that rage that seemed to spark inside. But he'd planted an idea that made her push the door shut with extra force when she was finally inside. She took her shoes off slowly, as though she needed more time to do what she had to do. She placed them beside the slightly larger trainers that had her temporary place in the hall, hung up her jacket, and walked calmly into the living room.
"You were a long time," he said. "Who was that?"
He was sitting on the sofa smoking a cigarette, as he always did after they'd had sex, as though he belonged there. Sometimes he had a cup of coffee as well, but as a rule, after his cigarette, he just showered and went home or to work, leaving her feeling like a harbour he only visited when it suited him, which was more or less the case.
Pierre Nurkleby had known Andreas Kjær for 4 years, since they'd ended up sitting next to each other at a work Christmas dinner. They'd got on so well, and conversation had been easy. He'd made her laugh. At the time, she hadn't laughed properly with a man for as long as she could remember. Nothing had happened that evening, not by a long shot, but because he was a team leader in the control center, they would meet every now and then. They continued to get on well, and this developed into stolen glances over food or coffee. Sometimes she found him at night as well, in her dreams. And then one Friday evening they bumped into each other in town, and at the end of the night she asked him, in what was a very direct way for her, if he was going the same way. She'd already seen the answer in his hungry eyes, and the fact that he was married with 2 children was simply not part of the equation at that point in time. Things took their course. Pierre's previous relationship had ended in arguments and clothes and shared memories being thrown out, and she had not been ready for commitment, only intimacy. She had initially suppressed any thought of morals and allowed herself to be swept along. And goodness, things were still fine. He was a good and considerate lover, rough and ready if she asked for it, but he never stayed the night. What had been exhilarating and exciting at first had gradually become habit. She had started to think about ending the relationship. It would fizzle out naturally at some point. She knew that Andreas was not the type to leave his wife and kids, but every time she had made a decision to say something, they ended up in bed. She liked herself less and less. She'd never dreamed she would be someone with a lover, a married one at that, if her mother only knew. "It was Henning," she said, and looked at him. "Henning Jule." Andreas Kjær straightened up. He was more alert, guarded. He stubbed out his cigarette quickly and vigorously. The horrible feeling that she'd had on the way up to the flat was reinforced. "You know him, don't you?"
"I've heard of him, yes,"
Kjær said, picking up his lighter from the table.
"What did he want? Why did he come here?"
Pierre Nurkleby studied him. "He wanted to talk to me about something," she said. Kjær lit another cigarette, then threw the lighter down on the table.
"About what?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Well," he said, and blew smoke out into the room. "I mean, it's a bit odd, isn't it, to come to your house like that?"
Pierre Nurkleby didn't answer. There was a moment's silence. "He came because someone got into Indicia with my username and password, and changed a report."
"Really?"
He looked up at her, but couldn't hold it for long. Took another couple of quick drags on his cigarette instead.
"What kind of report?"
"A specific incident on Mark Vian on the 11th of September 2007, Pierre Nurkleby said. "The night Yule lost his son." She looked straight at him, for a long time, without saying anything.
"It certainly wasn't me," she swiftly followed up, "but I've given some consideration to who it might have been."
Kjær looked up at her from the sofa.
"And what exactly did you mean by that?"
"What I mean, Andreas, is that I wonder if this," she pointed from him to herself and back again, "has perhaps been about more than just a fuck." He stood up.
"What are you saying, Pierre?"
Andreas was a lot taller than her, stronger, too. Still, she took a step towards him and said, "You are the only one who's seen me log into Indicia here." He snorted.
"You can't honestly suspect me of..."
He stopped and rolled his eyes. Pierre Nurkleby had dealt with enough liars in her time. She could recognize an amateur overreaction when she saw one. So she just smiled and watched him shift his weight from one foot to the other,
take another drag on his cigarette as he glared back at her, affronted. But he couldn't do it, and it didn't take long before he turned away and went over to the window. He stood there, smoking, as he pretended to look out at the town.
"Why did you steal my password?" she asked. He started to turn, but then stopped. "Was it to incriminate me?" she asked.
"You? No, I..."
A few seconds passed. He turned and went over to the coffee table, where he stubbed out his cigarette in the ashtray. Then he carried on into the bedroom and returned with his mobile phone. He took out the battery and SIM card and put them down on the bookshelf. He took her phone and did the same. When he'd finished, he stood with one hand on the bookshelf as though he needed something to hold on to. He didn't look at her when he said,
"They threatened me."
She could barely hear him. "Who are they?"
"I don't know," he said. "How did they threaten you?"
He took a moment before continuing.
"First they rang," he said. "Wanted me to give them access to Indicia. I would get good money, they said, but I refused, of course. Then they said they knew where I lived and things like that. And what my kids were called. What the dog was called."
He shook his head and looked up at her momentarily, as though to reassure himself she was still there. And when he continued, his voice was even quieter.
"Then, one day, they cut the dog's throat and left him on the veranda so my kids would find him. They said next time it would be one of us if I didn't help them, so I did what they asked me to do. I knew that you had access to Indicia, and..."
"Why did they need to get into Indicia?"
Pierre Nurkleby could hear how hard her voice had become. Cold, as though she was at work. She realized that it wasn't easy for him to talk about it, but she didn't give a damn. "Andreas, listen to me. I've just found out about your role in all this, and if I was smart, I would go straight to my superiors and tell them everything about you and the people who've threatened you. But then I would also have to admit that I've known there's been a certain security risk for a while now without having mentioned it. In the best-case scenario, you would lose your job, and in the worst, I would too. But whatever the case, we're talking about major changes. And even though no one is served by this becoming public knowledge, there's a real possibility that your wife would find out about what's been going on for the past 6 months. And I'm guessing you're not too keen for that to happen?" Kiar's head seemed to have sunk down between his shoulders. Pierre Nurkleby continued. "I would rather keep my job, too, and believe it or not, I have no interest in this affecting your family. So as I see it, we, or that's to say you, really, only have one choice left." She waited until he looked up at her. "Talk to Henning." Kiar was about to come up with some kind of protest, but she spoke before he could. "Tell him what you know about these people. If we're lucky, he won't write anything about our blunders." Kier closed his eyes, as though he hoped the nightmare would be over when he opened them again. "I'm going to have to go to work now," Pierre Nurkleby said, with a heavy sigh. "Do you know why?" She didn't wait for him to meet her eyes. "Because Henning's closest colleague was killed a few hours ago." Kier opened his eyes and lifted his chin. "It's too early to say whether the murder has anything to do with Henning, but it may well do. Henning hasn't been staying in his own flat recently because someone is after him."
"So you think it's safe for me to talk to him?"
"I think it's time to stop hiding, Andreas. It's time to start pulling your weight. Seriously, people are being killed."
"Yes, and I'm trying to stop that happening to anyone in my family, or me."
Pierre Nurkleby looked at him with increasing scorn. Even though it was easy enough to understand that he'd been thinking of his children all this time, he'd still put her in an impossibly difficult position. He had betrayed her, and she would never forgive him.
and she felt that it was actually quite a good thing that they'd got to this point. "I'm going to have a shower," she said, "and when I get out, Andreas, I'd like to hear that you've grown some balls."
Chapter 13. Trine closed her eyes. Only now, as she was transported silently towards Oslo, long after Henning had left, occasionally feeling the rhythm of the wheels on the tracks and junctions, did she realize how exhausted and sleepy she was. She leaned her head in towards the window and tried to imagine that the world would somehow be different when she woke up. But the fields were still flying past half a minute later, cold, wet expanses that rolled towards the hills and mountains far away on the horizon. Everything was as it had been, except it was all different now. She wasn't afraid for herself, but she was scared about what might happen to Henning if he continued his hunt. "You should help him," Trine said to herself. God knows she owed him. But how? What could she do when faced with people who wouldn't bat an eyelid at killing? The train swept past Kløfta, where Trine and Henning had grown up. The knowledge of what had happened in the house at Gjerdrumsveiden in Henning's bedroom made her shut her eyes again. She tried to block out the images that sometimes came to her, especially at night, but her father's frightened eyes would not be blinked away, or the sound of his bare feet as he crossed the floor when he'd pulled on his trousers, the careful knock on her door so as not to wake anyone else, the quiet in the house the next day. What happened later? Trine had told Pal Frederick about her father. Perhaps she should tell him about Jonas as well, now that it was all out, and Bodil Svenkerud. But she couldn't make up her mind, not even when she got off the train at Skøyen and took a taxi home to Ullern. Pal Frederick opened the door for her and pulled her into his arms as soon as she'd put down her things.
"Hello, my love," he said quietly.
"Hello," she replied, suddenly on the verge of tears.
"How are you?"
She pressed herself against him, didn't want him to see her tears. She mumbled something about being fine, a good trip, but that it was better to be home again.
"How about you?"
"I'm fine," he said. And she heard in his voice what lay beneath the words. Security. A home. The tears welled up again, and she had to force them back.
"Did you see Henning?"
he asked, shortly after. Trine pulled back abruptly and looked up at her husband, and then it dawned on her why Pal Frederick had not come to meet her.
"Yes," she said, and relaxed into his arms again. "How did it go?"
She didn't answer, just held him as close as she could. After what happened to Jonas, Trine had thought about taking her own life. She just wanted everything to disappear, the realization of what she'd done, the pain she'd inflicted on others. But Pal Frederick had managed to pick her up, as she now felt confident he would do again.
"What would you like to do now that you're going to be the Minister of Justice?" he'd asked before she started the job. "What are you passionate about?"
And Trine had thought about Jonas, decided that she would fight for children to grow up in a safe environment. "Children's rights," she'd said. And that was what had pulled her from the quagmire, the thought that she might be able to make a difference. And she'd managed to do a lot. She'd opened more children's safe houses around the country, and she'd gone to work with a sense of purpose and the desire to do something every day. But she'd avoided anything that might remind her of Henning and the past. To begin with, it was fine. Henning was off sick, and for a long time no one was certain he'd ever go back. When he did return to work again, she just avoided 123 News, knowing that she couldn't bear to see his byline photo with all the scars.
But obviously, it was difficult to avoid him completely, and it didn't take long before he was part of the new scene again, both as a witness in the Henriette Hagerup case and as the leading reporter when Tora Pulley was murdered. And when Trina herself was caught in the media crossfire, he was the only journalist who tried to help her. There was so much she wished she'd done differently. It might even be too late. She had the feeling she would never see him again, and so would never be able to repay him. But now, at least, he knew the truth, even though she hadn't dared tell him everything. Chapter 14. The city rushed towards him, and then slipped by outside the taxi window. Colors and people, rain and umbrellas, streetlights competing with an ever-darkening sky. The radio was on, but Henning wasn't listening. He had his bag on his knees and was clutching his phone, which he had turned off before he met Trina. Reluctantly, he turned it on, even though he knew there would be a deluge of text messages and missed calls. Bjarne Brogeland answered the phone as soon as Henning called, but he didn't say anything, just breathed heavily over the static on the line.
"Condolences," he said eventually. "I know you worked closely together."
"Are you there?" Henning asked. "At the scene?"
"Yes, I..."
"I have to get into his flat," Henning said. "See the place."
"Henning, you can't."
"Can you meet me outside? I'm on my way there now." Bjarne sighed.
"They're still going over the flat, Henning. I can't just take an outsider in. You know that."
Henning moved the phone into the other hand. "It would be easier for me to tell if there's anything unusual," he said. "I'm the one who's been there the most in the past week or so."
"That may well be," Bjarne said. "Anyway, regardless of whether I can get you in or not, we still have to wait until forensics are finished."
Henning looked out of the window again. "They might move things, take something away."
"They won't,"
Bjarne said. "You never know, you can't guarantee that, can you?" Neither of them said anything for a moment. Henning felt the taxi driver looking at him in the rearview mirror, but he didn't look up.
"Ivor texted me earlier on today," he said, after a while. "He wanted to show me something."
"What?"
"I don't know. We agreed that I'd go round this evening, when I'd..."
A few more moments' silence.
"Does it have anything to do with your case, do you think?"
"I don't know." Bjarne asked Henning to wait a moment. Someone asked the policeman something. Henning could hear the mumbling in the background. Ivor had been killed in the middle of the day, on a Sunday. Someone obviously thought it was worth the risk. Ivor must have found something, and it must be something to do with Henning's search. He was sure of it. What the hell could it be? Henning knew that Ivor had been concentrating on Rasmus Bjelland recently. It might be something about him. Maybe Ivor had managed to track him down, get something out of him. Henning had to try to find Bjelland himself, to establish what kind of relationship he'd had with Tora Pulley, why he'd wanted to get his revenge, and if it had anything to do with everything else that had happened.
"Would it perhaps not be better to meet at the police station?"
Bjarne asked when he came back.
"Then we can talk things through properly."
Henning shook his head.
"I can't face the main station right now, Bjarne. Harald Gierstad and all the others. Just can't do it."
"You don't have to have anything to do with them,"
Bjarne said.
"You can just talk to me."
"Meet me at Ivor's, then. We can talk there."
Bjarne sighed.
"I'll be more useful at Ivor's than in the main station. You know that, Bjarne. Help me get into the flat, then we can go through it together. I have to find out what he was going to show me."
The car stopped at some traffic lights. The engine automatically switched off, and there was silence. Henning could hear Bjarne breathing at the other end.
"Okay, then,"
he said eventually.
"I'll meet you outside."
Henning asked the driver to stop a block away from Ivar's flat. He needed some air, needed to walk, needed to think. Out of the car, he lifted his face to the drizzle that slowly washed the salt from his cheeks. Ivar was dead. Gone. Him too. Henning wanted to call Nora, but she would hardly want to talk to him. Not now. Perhaps never again. He had ruined her life, first by not being the husband he could and should have been, then by not waking in time to save Jonas. It was his fault that the wrong kind of people were after him. It was his fault that Ivar had been caught in the crossfire. And even if Henning managed to find them and get them put away, Nora would never get back what she'd lost. Every time they met, every conversation they had, would be a reminder. His phone rang. It was Bjarne.
"I can see you," he said. "Wait there."
Henning ended the call and did as he was told. Soon he saw Bjarne striding past 10 or 12 journalists, all of whom tried to talk to him. He dismissed them with a wave and angry shake of the head and hurried towards Henning. Bjarne held out his hand when he got there.
"It's just so awful," he said.
Henning shook his hand, but said nothing. They stood in silence for a few seconds, neither of them bothered by the cold drops of rain.
"Chaos over there,"
Bjarne said, and nodded towards the journalists.
"Stick close behind me, and don't say anything."
"I wouldn't dream of it," Henning thought.
"Okay,"
Bjarne said. A row of police cars was parked just outside the cordon. In addition to the journalists, a crowd of curious onlookers had gathered. Henning kept his eyes to the ground as they got closer, hoped that no one would notice him. But too late. He heard someone call his name. Henning didn't answer. Bjarne guided him past the two officers guarding the cordon.
"Why is Yule going in with you?"
The question went unanswered. Instead, Bjarne muttered something to one of the police officers. Henning concentrated on Bjarne's feet and his own. Sounds came and went through his head. Loud. Uncomfortable. They passed through the archway into the back courtyard. A forensic technician was coming in the opposite direction. Bjarne said hello. His voice was like a sound file played at slow speed, deep and gruff. Henning trudged up the stairs without looking at anyone. Before they went into Ivar's flat, Bjarne turned towards him.
"Ivar's not here," he said. "But there are still some remains. Wait a moment and let me see if..."
"It'll be fine," Henning said.
"I don't know how wise it is for you to see..."
"It'll be fine," Henning said again. Bjarne looked at him for a few seconds.
"Okay,"
he said. Then he pushed open the door. Henning felt his heart thumping. Faster and harder. He stepped into Ivar's flat and took his time to look around. Shoes, jackets, bottles by the cupboard, the open bathroom door, the light inside. The kitchen ahead of them, frying pan on the cooker, the smell of egg and bacon lingered. Plate by the sink, glasses in the washing up bowl. They were barely through the door when a voice from the living room said,
"Whoa, whoa, whoa, what are you doing, Bjarne?"
The sharp voice belonged to a petite, compact woman whose accent suggested she came from the north of Norway. She emerged with her hands up to stop him. Henning looked at her. It wasn't hard to guess she was from forensics.
"You can't take a civvy in here, not now!"
"He might be able to help," Bjarne explained. "He's been here before, in the past few days."
"Yes, but..."
"He'll be able to see if anything's out of place in a way that we can't," Bjarne interjected. "I promise you, Sarah,
We'll be out of your way in a couple of minutes." She didn't respond, just stood there glaring at them.
"Thank you," Bjarne said, taking it a silent assent. "I owe you one."
Henning turned towards the front door, looked at the row of shoes, the hooks on the wall, the coats and jackets, a clothes hanger. He turned slowly round and lifted his eyes towards the living room door, took a step forwards, looked at the clothes on the floor, the wires, a beer can, newspapers, the coal and ash in the fireplace. There was blood on the floor. Dark red. Henning had thought he'd be able to resist looking at it, but the colour was so deep that he stood there staring until his vision was blurred by saltiness. It was as though there was a magnet in the deep red blood that kept drawing his eyes back. He looked up, saw the hook on the ceiling.
"Is that where he was hanging?"
Bjarne exchanged glances with the technician. Henning looked from one to the other.
"There's bits of fabric up there," he said, "and so much blood in one place."
Neither Bjarne nor the technician answered, but he didn't need any confirmation. That meant there must have been at least two people involved. One person would never have managed to hoist Ivar up by himself.
"Can you see anything unusual in here?"
Bjarne asked. Henning studied the room, saw a candlestick on the windowsill with no wax on it, a vase of something that looked like dry twigs, book with the front cover facing down, two remote controls, another beside the telly. The small sideboard under the TV was closed. A blanket had been flung on the sofa. A lamp was on. He stopped when he got to the coffee table. "If Ivar was working on anything," he said, and felt acutely how hard it was to say his name out loud, "he used to spread his papers out all over that table there." He pointed. "But there's nothing there. No paper. No printouts."
"Do you think the people who did this took any papers with them?"
Henning nodded. "It's certainly possible," he said quietly.
"Sarah, do you know if anyone has taken stuff from the table?"
She frowned at him, then shook her head. They stood there, all three of them, looking around.
"I've seen enough," Henning said. "Get me out of here."
They went out into the kitchen. Henning turned around again, looked at the blood, at the rest of Ivar's flat. The police had presumably started to map his final movements, but he wondered if he could work that out on his own, without having to ask Bjarne. Henning looked up on the hat shelf in the hall, where Ivar usually left his car keys. Bjarne's phone started to ring, and he answered and opened the front door at the same time. Henning looked around again quickly. There was no one else in the hall. He reached up and managed to take Ivar's keys in the nick of time just before Bjarne turned round and held the door open for him.
"Are you coming?"
he asked. Henning nodded and left the flat. Chapter 15
"Stop,"
Charlie Highseater said.
"Stop, now."
Freddy pulled into the pavement and stopped.
"What is it?"
he asked.
"Wait here."
"Shouldn't I just wait here?"
Charlie repeated as he got out of the car. He looked in both directions and then ran across the road into the gallery. A bell tinkled above him as he entered the air-conditioned premises. Even that short dash across the road had made Charlie sweat. The cool air was refreshing.
"Hello," said the owner, a short man with a dark comb-over.
He came towards Charlie, the palms of his hands pressed together.
"A pleasure to see you, sir. How can I help you?"
"That painting there,"
Charlie said, and pointed at the large canvas that was in the window.
"Who painted it?"
"Ah, a mujer de miña vida," he exclaimed with delight.
Roberto Souza. He's from Castello Branco.
Charlie took a step closer.
It's in Portugal,
the owner enthused.
Can you take it down?
Charlie asked. The man looked questioningly at him.
You mean now?
Yes, now, out here.
Charlie pointed to the wall in front of them.
I'm interested in buying it, he added.
Ah, yes, of course, but let me just get my assistant. One moment, please.
The gallery owner called out a name and some instructions in his own language, and soon another equally short man appeared. They looked like twins, the same height, the same features, the same small, pointy chin. Not without difficulty, they managed to climb into the window and take down the painting. They then propped it up against the wall, as Charlie had asked them to do. The painting was of a woman in profile, with long, jet-black hair, against the golden-red sunlight of early evening. She was on a beach, staring longingly out to sea. Her hair fell beyond the edge of the painting, where two hands were just visible under the black locks. She was wearing a white dress.
The painting is 77 by 53 centimeters, the owner told him. The same as the Mona Lisa.
How much does it cost?
Charlie asked.
34,500 reais.
Can you deliver it to my home?
The two men sent each other a speedy and thrilled look, then turned back to Charlie.
I'll pay extra if you can deliver it today, he said.
Of course, sir, the owner said eagerly. We'll arrange that.
Charlie went over to the till and put his credit card down on the counter. The owner was promptly beside him, the sweat breaking on his brow from the last few minutes of exertion.
Roberto Souza is a very talented painter, he said.
I'm sure he is, but I just want this one.
Of course, one moment.
Charlie turned back to look at the painting. It was perfect. She was perfect. When the doorbell rang a couple of hours later, Charlie was sitting on a bar stool in the kitchen, reading the Norwegian papers on his mobile phone. Isabel called from the living room.
Who is it?
Charlie didn't answer, just went over to the intercom on the wall beside the door.
Yes?
Delivery for Mr.
15th floor.
Charlie stood by the door and waited for the lift to ping open. He said hello to the two men who carried the painting in. Their shoes immediately left marks on the floor tiles.
Where do you want it? The living room, Charlie said.
He showed them in. Isabel was sitting reading a fashion magazine when they came in. She stood up and looked at them with round, curious eyes.
Over there,
Charlie said, pointing at a bare white wall behind the dining table. The men did as they were told.
What have you bought?
Isabel asked. Charlie sent her a long look.
Is it a painting?
She asked.
Oh.
The large rectangle was packed in bubble wrap and paper.
Shall we hang it on the wall for you?
The men asked.
Just leave it there, thanks,
Charlie said, pointing at the floor.
Okay.
Charlie gave them each 100 reais. The men bowed their heads in thanks and quickly retreated. Charlie locked the door behind them and ran back into the living room.
How exciting, Isabel said.
Charlie removed the paper and bubble wrap with care. And there she was. A mulher da minha vida.
Oh.
Isabel said dreamily.
How?
She put an arm round him from behind, pulled him to her.
So?
Charlie just stood there, looking at the hair, the beach, the sand, the sunset.
Is it?
Charlie wasn't listening.
I mean, she doesn't have my curls, but...
Should he say something? No, that would be nasty. And then Isabel kissed him on the neck and slid her hands down over his chest muscles, stomach, and then lowered herself down onto her knees in front of him. He looked at her. A mujer da miña vida. Woman of my life. Love of my life. He could swear. He could even smell her. Chapter 16. Diana spoke into his phone on the way down the stairs, but hung up as soon as they came out into the courtyard. The rain was heavier, splashing on the cobbles. "Could you drive me to 123 News?" Henning shouted over the steady hiss of the rain. Diana looked at him for a long time, then at his shoulder bag.
"You're not thinking of working now, are you?"
Diana asked loudly.
"No," Henning said. "I just want to be there."
Diana gave an understanding nod.
"Of course."
They went out onto the street, into the chaos and cordons, and tightly packed journalists under umbrellas ready to attack. But Henning didn't look at them, didn't listen to the questions they shouted at him and Diana, and instead concentrated on the reflection from the street lamps on the dark, wet asphalt.
"Have you found any evidence?" Henning asked when they got into the car.
Diana put the heat on full blast. The windscreen wipers went back and forth briskly. Diana looked over at him.
"I can't say anything about that at the moment, Henning. Certainly not to you. You can't start your own investigation."
"And you think I'll just accept that?"
"Henning, I..."
Diana searched for words. Henning sighed. "Fine," he said.
"I'll find other ways."
He knew that Diana was only trying to protect him, but there was no way he was going to leave the police to investigate Ivor's death alone. The question was how he would get hold of the information if Diana wasn't willing to supply it. Henning's secret online source in the police, 6 Tiermes 7, had not been active for some time now. Diana drove slowly and made no unexpected maneuvers in the traffic. The police radio peeped every now and then, but Diana had turned down the volume. Henning leaned his head against the window, felt it banging against the glass. Outside the window, the buildings and dark streets passed by. The cars and buses sprayed water over the pavements, and pedestrians made themselves as small as they could beneath their umbrellas.
"Where are you going to stay tonight?"
Diana asked. Henning thought about Veronica Nansen, who he assumed would be happy to open her home to him if he asked, but he didn't want to expose her to any more danger.
"Don't know,"
he replied. Diana held his gaze for so long that the car almost mounted onto the curb. He realized this just in time and managed to pull back into the road. Henning grabbed the handle above the door. Soon, they turned into Urtegata, where 123 News had its offices. Bjarne stopped in front of big black iron gates, let the engine run.
"You'll have to come down to the main station tomorrow," he said, "for questioning, in a more formal setting. If Gunderson's death has anything to do with you, then it won't be just Sandland and me who want to know what you've discovered."
Henning considered this with dread.
"Nora," he said as he opened the door, "you'll keep an eye on her, won't you?"
"Of course,"
Bjarne said.
"Okay," Henning got out. "Thanks for the lift."
Henning didn't have his staff card with him, so he had to ring the bell and wait for someone to come down. He didn't recognize the girl who eventually appeared, but she seemed to know who he was.
"Come in, Henning," she said. "Everyone's up on the second floor."
He went up the stairs behind her, even though it made his hips ache. Henning hadn't been into the office for 2 weeks. He'd managed to persuade the home news editor, Heidi Kjus, to give him 2 weeks' unpaid leave so he could focus fully on finding Jonas's killer. On the way up to the second floor, He wondered how the other journalists would react to his presence. Everyone knew about his complicated relationship with Ivor. They were friends, but with Nora in the middle, too. The girl in front of him pushed the door open and went into the offices. It was so quiet in there. The only person to be seen when he rounded the corner by the coffee machine was the man sitting alone at the front desk. "We're all in the big meeting room," the girl told him. Henning heard hushed voices, a glass or cup being put down on the table. He stopped outside because he couldn't face going in. But Heidi Kuss spotted him through the open door, jumped up from her chair, and came out. She looked even thinner than before, if that was possible, but was, as always, dressed like a lawyer, in a smart skirt, shirt and jacket, all in the same dark blue. And she was, as always, extravagantly made up, but the usual stiffness in her face, that middle management look, had been replaced by a softer expression. A welcome change, Henning thought. It was good to know that Heidi could be human, too. But he could see that she hadn't shed any tears, as several other colleagues clearly had. "Hello, Henning," she said, and stopped in front of him. Then she took another step closer and put her arms around him. It felt strange to be hugged by a person he'd argued with so often, but he hugged her back all the same. What surprised him even more was discovering that he felt like bursting into tears. "I tried to ring you," she said quietly into his ear. They let go of each other.
"Right, I've been at the scene of the crime," he said.
"I heard. How..."
She stopped herself and looked away briefly. "I take it you're covering the case," Henning said.
"Yes, but it's fairly low-key at the moment. Not many people can face it, or deal with it for that matter, so it's mainly Norwegian news agency information."
Henning nodded.
"We've just had a small ceremony," she continued. "Sture said a few words. He's written the obituary as well. You should read it. It's good."
Henning nodded. "Have the police been here?" he asked.
"Yes," Heidi said, then walked past him. "They took his hard drive and all his papers and notepads."
Henning hadn't expected anything less, but had hoped all the same that he might get a look at Ivor's notes first.
He followed her over to the empty desk. A single lit candle cast a shiny golden sheen on the black screen. Heidi took a deep breath.
"It's so..."
She shook her head and turned her face away.
"What did they ask about? The police, that is."
Heidi turned to look at him again.
"The usual, I guess. What he was working on, if he'd been anywhere in particular before the weekend, if he'd written anything recently that might have upset someone."
She shrugged.
"And had he?"
Henning asked. Heidi shook her head. "He was in Tønsberg with you last week, and then he was in hospital for a few days with..." She stopped. Henning thought about Nora again, about how she must feel right now. They stood there looking at the candle for a while. The silence was broken by a telephone ringing. It took a couple of seconds before Henning realized it was his. He took it out of his pocket.
"I have to take this," he said, then retreated a few steps.
"Okay, I'll go back into the others for the moment. It would be nice if you came in too, Henning."
He didn't answer, just nodded and waited until she'd left. Then he answered and put the phone to his ear.
"Ah, there you are at last," Pia Nørklebø said. "I was starting to get worried."
"What's up?" Henning asked.
"I've got something for you," she said.
She told him about her relationship with Andreas Kjær and that he had confessed shortly after Henning had left.
"He's agreed to meet you tomorrow morning," she said. "Do you know where Scar is?"
Henning thought quickly.
"At the end of Maridalen, is that right?"
"Yes. Start walking towards Øyungen, and he'll find you along the path. He's going for a run tomorrow morning around 10 o'clock.
"Okay, great. Thank you."
"I want you to call me afterwards so we can discuss what to do next."
Henning thought about it
Okay, he said again.
I sincerely hope that you won't write anything about this, Henning. I'm trying to protect myself here as well as Andreas, not to mention the force. The man on the street has to trust the police.
Henning was far beyond the point where he was thinking about journalism.
Don't worry.
Absolutely not, he said.
Speak tomorrow, then.
Chapter 17. It hurt to lift her hands to her face, to wipe away the tears. It hurt to pull the blanket tighter around her. It hurt to hear the sound of her own breathing. Everything hurt. To blink, swallow, the slightest turn of her head. What hurt least was to squeeze and shake Jonas's snow globe, to see the snowflakes swirl around and slowly fall to the bottom again. Nora dreaded the night when everything was quiet around her. She knew that Ivor would find her in the dark, that she would try everything possible to block him out, to avoid thinking about his blood-smeared face, the pool of blood underneath him. But she couldn't. She wondered if he'd thought about her before he died, or the child, or if everything had been consumed by trying to understand why he had to die. The dread, the pain. The kettle in the kitchen hissed more and more furiously. Drawers were opened and closed, cupboard doors opened and closed. Agnes Clementson, Nora's mother, had got into the car as soon as she heard what had happened. She had pushed her way through all the people outside the police cordon and found Nora sitting on a bench behind Ivor's building with a trauma management expert beside her. The woman, who was around Agnes's age, had looked up and immediately realized who she was, and without a word being said, Agnes had sat down and pulled Nora to her and stroked her hair. Nora shook the snow globe a little and held it up to her nose. Once upon a time, it had smelled of Jonas. She leaned her head against the back of the sofa and closed her eyes tight, reflected on how bad she'd been at making a real home and building something permanent, how hard she'd tried by keeping things just so, how little she had actually achieved. Curtains and silver polish, cushions that weren't lying as they should, toys that should be put in plastic boxes at the end of the day, jackets that should be hung up, cupboard doors that should be closed, shoes that should be stamped clean of snow before going indoors. Nora knew that she had got all this from her mother, and more. But what the hell was the point? What the hell had it given her? None of it meant anything, when she had no one to do it for. Henning. Jonas. Ivor. Loss. Grief. Pining. Only brief glimpses of happiness. How was she going to carry on now? How would she ever find joy in anything after this? There was a click in the kitchen, and the hissing stopped. Nora heard her mother pour the hot water into a teapot.
Goodness!
Nora opened her eyes again and looked towards the kitchen. She heard a magnet being put back onto the fridge again.
You haven't shown me this.
Her mother came out into the living room with a small photograph in her hand. Nora looked at her.
You haven't been here since I got pregnant, Mum.
A soft smile slipped over her mother's lips, and she tilted her head.
How wonderful. Is it a boy or a girl? I've never understood how they can tell from a picture like this.
Don't know, Mum.
Don't you want to know?
Mum.
Her mother studied the photograph for a little longer, then disappeared out into the kitchen again. She soon returned with a tray of clinking cups and a steaming pot of tea. She put the tray down and set a cup in front of Nora.
Here,
she said. Nora forced herself to sit up. The thought of putting anything in her mouth right now made her stomach churn. Her lips and throat were dry, and her tongue felt alien.
Drink, her mother said. You need some fluids.
Her mother tried to smile. She sprinkled some sugar into her tea and stirred it. The spoon chimed against the porcelain. She put the spoon down and helped herself to a Ritz biscuit. Then she sat back and looked around. Nora knew what was going on in her head. She was evaluating what was needed. If there was anything she could paint or sew, anything she could get rid of or improve. Agnes Clemetson was a person who could not sit still for very long, who could never enjoy sitting against a wall feeling the warmth of the early spring sun. She always had to be doing something. And now, Nora would be her mother's project. She knew that, and she didn't know if she could handle it. She'd done something to her hair since the last time they'd met, Nora thought. Dyed it a darker brown. It was cut short, into the neck, full and wavy. She had more wrinkles on her face, more folds in her skin. It struck Nora that she didn't know much about her mother anymore, that several years had passed without them having a proper conversation. There had somehow never been time, or they hadn't been good enough at making the time. After Jonas died, there wasn't room for much else, unless it was work-related, and her parents hadn't exactly beaten a path to her door. They'd kept a distance, said they were there if she needed any help. They didn't want to fuss. "How's Dad?" Nora asked.
"Well, you know," her mother said, then waited a beat. "Your father's fine. He started to play golf."
"Has he?"
"Yes. Now that he's retired, you know, he needs something to do."
"Hmm." A dog barked outside. A car drove by. The city carried on.
"Has anyone else called?"
Her mother's voice was soft and warm again.
"Cecily," Nora replied, "and Lisa."
"Oh, lovely." Her mother was pleased. "How are they? I haven't seen them in 100 years.
"Well..."
Nora thought about her friends, who were probably sitting on the sofa right now as well, as they usually did, wrapped up in a blanket, surrounded by their families. Everything was as it should be. For them. In place. It made Nora cry again. It started with a sob when she drew breath, and then just grew and grew. She was so angry, so fucking furious with Ivor, with Henning, with herself, with life and the world. Her mother got up and hurried out into the kitchen. A moment later, she returned with a kitchen roll and tore off a few sheets. Then she sat down quietly beside her daughter and dried her tears. Chapter 18. When Henning entered the meeting room, everybody stopped talking. They all looked at him. He felt the urge to say something, to break the silence, but no words came out. Instead, Ricky Ringheim, the head of the gossip pages, came over and gave him a hug. Knut Hammerstad from the foreign desk followed. Some of his male colleagues offered their hands.